Welcome to Money Maze Curated Podcasts. We created this spin-off channel to highlight a selection of innovative firms in the finance sector and beyond. If you visit www.moneymazepodcast.com, you can also sign up to our newsletter to keep up to date with episode releases and access a range of resources and materials relevant to each guest. If you enjoy this episode, please follow this channel and leave a review. Thank you for listening. On the Money Maze Curated channel, we've had detailed investment conversations with the principals of some fascinating firms. Japanese equities with Arcus, European opportunities with Lansdowne, social infrastructure with Nucor, and technology metals with TechMed. Today we have our first entry into the world of an alternative asset manager, providing solutions to banks, asset managers, and other financial entities seeking capital solutions to complex problems. With offices across the US, Asia, and Europe, Orchard Global may not be a household name, but its tentacles reach out far and wide. And over from the US to today, we welcome Paul Horvath, CEO. Welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Good afternoon, Simon. Great to be here.
Well, I am welcoming you. I'd like to make a shout out to Jen Prosek of Prosek Communications, who made the introduction. And you are the second Horvath to appear in the last few months.
I see.
Because Michael Horvath, back in July, is the co-founder of Strava, the world's most popular sports app. And we opened with a mini-series we're conducting at the moment on private equity and sport and sports businesses. Now, as we went through our research, I discovered, actually through LinkedIn, two great friends of the show, Steve Hullett and David Forbes Nixon, know you well and gave you resounding endorsements.
The check is in the mail.
It can come by me. But let's start, as we like to, with a little look back. Why finance? What was your journey?
First of all, I just want to comment on Horvath. We're taking over the world. You realize that. But in all seriousness, Horvath means Croatia. So this other Horvath and me, our great-great-great-great-grandfather did a deal with the Hungarians. The Horvath was very good at defending against the various invaders, the various sultans coming. And they did a deal in the, you know, sort of 15th century that the Horvath got a nice castle if they would defend Vienna and Budapest from the oncoming invaders. So we're all sort of related in that way. And that's why we have that extra fight in us.
Fantastic. But when did the escape to the US take place?
Well, actually, it's interesting. Along the theme of the fight, my father was one of the student protesters who ended up starting, amongst many others, the revolutionaries who started the Hungarian Revolution in 1956. So they succeeded at first, but then what actually happened is they had made good progress. They actually got the Hungarian army to turn against the Russians. But unfortunately for them, the Suez Canal flared up and Khrushchev said, wait a second, is this a coordinated attack? He threw in 20 divisions. The Hungarians lost something like 20,000 people. So my father and all of his buddies, we was able, you know, this is before the time of cell phones or landlines or anything. They got 400,000 of the elite, the students, the professors, the entrepreneurs, the real energy to leave Hungary in a six-week period in 1956. My father was one of the lucky ones. There was a quota that year. Roughly 50,000 could go to the US. The rest ended up going to Canada and Australia and Switzerland and South Africa. But my father was one of the last ones who made it in the US quota. So he came over to Camp Kilmer in either New Jersey or Pennsylvania or somewhere in the Eastern Seaboard in 1956. And, you know, the rest is history.
What a great story. I hope one member of your family has written the book.
My wife actually is a journalist. She's been with the Wall Street Journal for over 30 years. And my father isn't getting any younger. So we're writing it all down. And without exaggeration, it's an incredible story. And people want to buy the movie rights. So it's an incredible story.
We did do a personal podcast for somebody who wanted their history recorded, interestingly. And so it's there.
Well, we might have to, you know, give Prosek a call and we could set something up. By the way, he's much more interesting than I am. Well, but you're stuck with me for now.
Okay. So journey into finance.
Yeah, you know, so it's interesting. I started out my career, I went to an economics major at Georgetown University. And all these offers from high finance, the likes of Drexel, Burnham and Lambert and others were waving many dollars in our face in the late 80s. But at the urging, actually, my father, who never helped me or interfered in any of my affairs, he said, go talk to this guy. I think he was either the president of Morgan Stanley, very senior person at Morgan Stanley. And he said, this is an informational interview. Don't ask him for a job and don't take one if he gives one, but he has some perspective. And what he told me is I had these high finance jobs, but I also had an offer from the Federal Reserve. This is the late 80s. And he said, well, first of all, if you're going to go anywhere, you're coming to Morgan Stanley, but don't do it. Go to the Fed. And I was like, well, why would I do that? And he said, what you learn at the Fed will define your career. And I said, really? And I said, how do I know that? He said, well, I started at the Fed and look, I'm the president of Morgan Stanley. Well, how true that was. It was the best advice that I've ever gotten. I'd like to say that the best advice came from my father or my parents. It usually does. But I went to the Federal Reserve because of this guy. So I went at a very interesting time. I went during the late 80s, early 90s, during the savings and loan crisis in the US. It was wasn't quite the global financial crisis, but it wasn't far off of it. And I learned many important lessons, but the one or two that are sort of germane to this conversation is I learned that he or she in the private sector who works with the sovereign, works with the central banks, works with the banks to help the sovereign recapitalize the financial system during and after times of financial crisis will make supernormal returns. I couldn't believe a very idealistic young little Paul Horvath said, wait, how can we do these deals? There was a deal I remember, it was called the first Gibraltar deal. I think Ron Perlman was the lead investor. And it was five Texas thrifts that they had banded together. And it was pretty much US government principal protected downside. And unless they really, really, really mismanaged things, it was almost a guaranteed 15 to 20% per annum upside. And so I said to my father, who I still get career advice from, if I ever see an opportunity this good again, I want to be involved, not as a regulator or as a intermediary, which is what I did at JP Morgan and Merrill Lynch for the better part of a decade and a half or so, but I want to be involved as a principal. So that's what set me on my path, not only into finance, but into the little corner of regulatory capital arbitrage or capital relief, which was the basis upon which I founded Orchard Global.
But before we get to Orchard Global, those were the lessons from the Fed. JP and Merrill's, one lesson from each of those that stayed with you?
Yeah, so I'm glad you asked. So that was where I got the idea to do something if I saw that opportunity. Merrill was basically, I like to say I had incredible vision. And after business school, I came over to Europe. Again, I'd like to say I have incredible vision to open up the European markets. But the truth of it is, I had met a girl, a German woman at Georgetown, and I really wanted to be in Europe. And so I came here to follow a girl. Now, with the benefit of hindsight, I was about 3 or 4 years ahead of this American invasion. I came in 94. So I didn't make a name for myself. You can either be really smart, like a Mike Milken who creates something, or you can do what I did, which is import-export. I took US-based financial technologies and I exported them to the non-US world. So I may have not been the smartest in the room, but I was the smartest one in Europe because I had this new thing that very few people in Europe and Asia had. And from 94 to 99, I was at Merrill Lynch and I made a name for myself, again, exporting US-based financial technologies to the non-US world. It was for that reason that JP Morgan hired me. They hired me because they had come up with a way for a bank to shore up its tier one capital ratio without having to issue equity. Banks need capital largely to buffer, against credit losses. So they worked out, wait a second, if a bank could buy insurance on their credit portfolio, then they would need less capital. So they literally created the credit derivative market, which is a credit derivative. You can make it as complicated as you want. It's just a tradable insurance contract on credit risk. So what JP Morgan came up with is that if banks could buy a portfolio, a credit protection on their bank portfolio, they'd need less capital. So these are the geniuses there. Again, they started it. I was hired to help export it. You know, I helped get JP Morgan in front of, over 150 non-US banks at the board and CEO level. My regulatory background actually came in handy because we had to convince 14 or so other central banks to approve this balance sheet optimization, much in the way that my former employer, the Federal Reserve, had. And we got over 60 banks to do about $160 billion of this stuff in the 99 to 02 period. Now, we did a deal with Deutsche Bank. They reverse engineered the technology, became our biggest competitor. So between ourselves, Deutsche Bank, and three or four others, we did about 300 billion of the stuff. And it was interesting. What it meant was that it was the 01-02 downturn in the post.com and so on. It was one of the first times in financial history that you saw a credit downturn without a resulting banking crisis. So this was a really good sort of capital management tool. It took this concentrated credit risk and dispersed it so that it would be less harmful to the financial system. So those were the lessons learned from JP Morgan and Merrill. So then what happened? From 2002 to 2007, or 2003 to 07, you didn't see a lot of this capital optimization happening for two reasons. The first one is banks didn't really need the capital. They were actually buying back stock from retained earnings. But the second one is the rules changed. That solution, if you will, worked under the Basel I. You know, the central bank to the central banks is actually based in Basel. So Basel I was the old rules. Basel I was migrating to Basel II. Fast forward, and it's good we're in England because I can tell the story, people recognize the names. So I was back at Merrill Lynch, and we had a very strong FIG, Financial Institutions Group M&A practice, led by one of the greatest bankers of them all, a certain Andrea Orcel, who I think is running Unicredito or something right now. He was the banker to the acquirers, and one of his biggest clients was Sir Fred Goodwin over at the Royal Bank of Scotland. Now, Sir Fred really wanted to buy a very large Dutch bank, ABN AMRO. Now, if he had asked my opinion, I'd say, we're about to go into financial crisis. Do you really want to, you know, but he didn't really ask my opinion. What we did do, though, is I said, okay, well, if you're going to buy that bank at that price, you're going to need capital wherever you can find it. And, you know, we did the normal things that banks do. I think we did a sub-debt issue. We did, issued them some equity. You know, our selling company came up a way to, like, I think they sold LaSalle Bank. You know, they did. But I took my best guy, actually a former intern of mine, who is now my partner and Orchard Global CIO, John Young. We threw him over the Chinese wall. He worked with Sir Fred and the ABN folks and the Dutch and English regulators. And they came up with the first Basel II and having an applicability to Basel III compliant version of this solution. So that was one of the many ways in which Royal Bank of Scotland had enough capital to make that acquisition. So it's the second half of 07. We now have, or I have, a solution to the banking crisis that the banking system didn't yet realize it had on its hands. There was one problem. I was at a bank. And I remember going up with my parents and my in-laws. I mentioned my wife is German. We go to the ski lodge every year for Christmas and New Year's. And I was telling them about it. And my father said, well, you know, remember 20 years ago when you said, if you ever see an opportunity this good, well, this is the opportunity. So you've got to do something. And I started returning the calls. Both Abu Dhabi and Singapore had been telling me, get out of banking, manage money for us. And some version of that is what we did. And the idea was created in 07, but in early 08, that's when I teamed up with actually a Singaporean friend and client of mine, and we created Orchard Global. And we actually started out, and for 15 years or so, we're headquartered in Singapore, actually. So that's how it all started. And I think that the lesson is listen to your father when he gives you good advice, because on two occasions did he give advice, and two times that I listened to it, and, you know, the rest is history, as they say.
And you actually missed a really important detail, which is you go to Europe to pursue a lady from university, and you end up marrying her. But that's
because exactly. And follow your heart as well. that's exactly. And we're still married, and we have three lovely, beautiful, and successful daughters as well.
Fantastic. Tell me about Orchard Global today.
So Orchard Global today, it is still what, when I found the company, it is today what it was then. We are fixed income alternative asset, which means we're more, what I like to say to our private wealth customers is we are invested with us to stay rich rather than to get rich. If you want to get rich, go to Sand Hill Road, go invest in some VC or go to a casino somewhere and, you know, hopefully you win big. But once you've gotten there, whether you're indeed, we have some very prominent private investors, but most of our investors are sovereign wealth and pension plans who are looking to just, they need to get high single digit, low double digit returns, but they really need low volatility around those returns, and they really, really want to have capital preservation. So that's what we do. So what it means is that Orchard will necessarily underperform in a big beta-driven rally. However, by intent and design, Orchard Global has historically, and I hope will continue to outperform when volatility is high, and most importantly, when banks are under stress. And so we only grow when we see opportunity to grow. So we have not done unbridled growth. You know, we've raised about, to check the numbers, but I think 15 or 16 billion in capital. But, you know, a lot of our funds are private debt funds. So when the deals are over, we give the money back. So we've given sort of six or seven back. So we're currently in the 8 billion to 9 billion range. However, we see a lot of opportunity now. So because we see opportunity, because volatility is starting to get high and banks, we think, are very much under stress and need capital. Banks are sort of the canary in the coal mine for the rest of the economy. So we can debate whether or not winter is coming in the macro economy. Some of it's going to depend on who wins this U.S. election. But I'll tell you right now that in many jurisdictions, banks are already acting as if in their demand for capital, that winter is already here. So we are in the process of growing from that 8 to 9 billion to, if we raise what we're targeting to raise, probably grow by 50%. So about 12 billion. But again, not because we just decided to. We see the opportunity and we're going to raise it and put it to work.
120 professionals, more or less?
Yeah, I think a little bit more. 138, I think it moves around. But that's interesting because I don't know if you ever read Sapiens, but the world changes once you go above 150. I mean, even now, before COVID, I pretty much knew everybody's name in the company, knew their history. We've barely even used headhunters because we just hired all the people we knew from JP Morgan, from Deutsche Bank, and from the diaspora of folks. You know, we're larger now. And as you mentioned, we do have a presence still in Singapore, a small office in Seoul. London is our biggest office. Toronto, a small office in New York, and in Houston.
So if I'm right, you do two things essentially. There's a solutions business and an asset management business.
Yes, but the solutions business, we're not consultants who sort of charge by the hour. The solution will have an investment that comes with it. So it's sort of bundled into one, if you will.
So can you give me an example for listeners so they can visualize how that looks?
So maybe two or three different examples over two or three different parts of time. I started the company in 08, as I mentioned, and it was kind of, it's better to be lucky than smart. By the time I, you know, was reasonably senior at Merrill, so they didn't just say, oh, you can just leave tomorrow. There was a bunch of things I needed to help them do because they had their own issues. And pretty much the day or two after we did the Lone Star transaction where Merrill kind of basically sold off the remaining $32 billion of their problem book to Lone Star, then I was sort of free to go. I took a couple of weeks off and I started in, I think it says in LinkedIn, I started Orchard in late August 08. I said, okay, we have our company, we have our partners. All we need is a financial crisis and then we're in business. Well, guess what? 2 weeks later, Lehman happens and we were in business. And it was, I mean, I knew it at the time, but it was the best way for us to really start up. What I actually did is rather than creating a company, I bought into, bought half of, you know, a small company from my Singaporean Canadian friend, client, and partner. And we decided to use that platform to grow. So we were ready to go. Well, it was a great time to start because everybody else had legacy problems. The global financial crisis had kicked in earnest and they were licking their wounds. We were fresh and ready to go. We had a small little fund. It was in good shape. And I'll leave the name, address, and telephone number, but one of those regulators that I knew well said, hey, it's great that you're in business. This particular sovereign had taken a large equity stake in one of their national champion banks. It looked like they weren't going to make capital compliance come year end. So they said, and their sort of parliament wasn't going to let them buy more of that. So they said, hey, if you ever want to do one of those things, if you have money to put to work, name your price and we're going to say yes. And again, this is how this works. It's part of the solution. This is me talking to the regulator about one of their banks. I even said, well, what if they don't like the price? They're like, they're going to like the price. Just make sure you can get the capital. So that's an example of a solution. It wasn't only us. There was one or two others, but there's a reasonable chance that if we hadn't got that done, if that bank hadn't got that bridge capital, you know, it's a G8 country, that could have been the trigger that, you know, made that global financial crisis a lot worse. So that's a solution. Let me give you another example. Q2 2020, one European bank, one US bank. Because we are the, if you will, the bank whisperers, we usually don't, we know the CEO, but this is capital stuff. It's more CFO or loan exposure management group. But in this case, who's the CEO? And it was, I think, late March, early April 2020. Hey, how's it going? I just got a call from the head of state. We're going to have to lend to, you know, the who's who of that particular G7 countries, you know, best companies. If they go down, there is no more Western economy. We're going to need capital. You know, Orchard, are your friends in, you know, Texas and the Gulf and Asia, you know, ready to go? Because we're like, absolutely, what can we do? And we got the same call from one of the big US banks. And again, we were able to provide capital during that critical period. And we like those kind of situations. Yes, we're providing a solution and we come up with the actual financial solution. But the real solution is we are there. We have the trust of the sovereign and of the leaders of these banks to be that capital when nobody else is in a position to give that capital.
So one of the things you've been alluded to is Basel I and Basel II, and now we have Basel III. Mm-hmm. Steve Hullett was talking to me, and he was talking about how you are mitigating risk for this. Again, this is new. Maybe just explain Basel III and the changes in requirements and how you are providing I'm going to use the word solution, you may correct me, to this issue.
The best way to answer that question is, especially from the European side, more. The reason why these capital rules came in was the global financial crisis exposed that the system was too leveraged. I mean, you literally, US banks didn't have this because they had other constraints, but you literally had major European banks that were 50, in some cases 100, but 50 times leveraged, i.e. 2% capital. So a $100 billion bank would have $2 billion in capital. The problem with that is if you just have a 2.1%, or let's just say 3% decline in the value of the assets, the bank's wiped out. And you had a couple of ones, and Switzerland jumps to mind, where the asset base of the two large banks there were sort of three or four times the GDP of the country. So you had banks that were bigger than the country. And the regulators at the national level and at the Basel level said, you know, no mas. Whatever happens, as a, you know, Dodd-Frank in the US, Basel II and then Basel III in Europe, whatever it is, we just want more capital. The first bank I studied it abroad, and I studied the Renaissance in Italy in my junior year. It was wonderful. And in fact, that girl that I chased over here, we got married actually in Italy, right near where I studied. But the first, you know, sort of modern bank, Monte de Paschi di Siena, was started in 1492. And from 1492 till about the 1990s, Glass-Steagall sort of loosened the rules. You know, banks were pretty much utilities. There's booms or bust, and utilities mean single-digit returns, a safe place to invest and store your capital. Well, Glass-Steagall changed and some things changed over here in Europe. And for a decade or two, banks became highly leveraged in almost casinos, if you will. And, you know, heads I win, tails the taxpayers lose. And that was not something that the regulators wanted to replicate. Now, have they overreacted since? You know, probably. I hope so. The more that the regulators overreact, the greater the arbitrage opportunity is for us. So under the old rules, banks needed about 2% capital. Under Basel II and then Basel III, and now we look to Basel IV, the capital requirement goes up. Just to frame you have to know how big your market is. To frame the question, the top 30 banks, the systemically significant financial institutions, they have about 100 trillion, my billions and trillions, they have about 100 trillion of assets. So under the old rules, there would need to be 2 trillion in capital. Under the new, it's about 10 or 11. So that's an $8 or $9 trillion capital shortfall. Now, since the global financial crisis, there's been equity that's been issued, but it's only like a trillion. There's been these alternative tier one or COCOs. We were never big fans of those. They're great for the bank, bad for the investor. And we were telling people, no, 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 don't invest in that. We even pressured here in this country, the UK regulators, you really should not sell that to retail. In the US, you can't really sell to retail because that's good until it's not good. And we told people, especially in Switzerland, read the docs. That stuff can go really bad really quickly. And people said, oh, they'll always pay off. It's Credit Suisse. We're like, well, maybe, but that's not what it says in the docs. So when, you know, the Credit Suisse thing happened and people said, we're going to sue, I was like, well, maybe, except the doc says they can do this. So, you know, caveat emptor. Anyway, maybe there was maybe one and a half trillion in equity issuance, maybe another 500 billion in COCOs. There still is a structural, if you will, capital shortfall. So we're there to help make up the difference. So, you know, there's a lot of new entrants into this. It used to be called regulatory capital relief. Now it's called SRT. You know, the first question I get from investors is, you've been talking about this for, you know, the better part of two decades or so. It was clearly a niche kind of boutique-y product that you could get supernormal returns then. Now that there's so many new entrants, is there still value there now? And the answer is, you know, it depends. But when banks need capital, there is. And it's probably a good thing that it's becoming a more accepted, more mainstream asset class. Because again, when that's most needed is when banks need capital. So they needed capital during the financial crisis. We had that conversation. They needed capital, you know, just for a quarter or two during COVID. Well, guess what? Starting about a year ago or so, banks need capital again. Now, different reasons. There's some regional stuff. You know, the Germans are worried about, they made it through the winter or two, but these are pretty warm winters, a cold winter. You know, they haven't replaced all that natural gas. So they're worried about that. So they want to shore up their capital. The Canadians and here in the UK, it's a different problem. With the rates starting to come down, this will take a little bit of pressure off. But if you look at your average Canadian bank, 50% of their balance sheet is residential mortgages, which reset. So if they made that loan to that plumber, that $1 million loan to that plumber, well, the plumber, you know, at 1%, you know, the plumber can pay that $10,000 a year in interest. But if all of a sudden it resets to 60%, can that plumber make that $60,000 in interest? Maybe not. So Canadian banks, half their balance sheets, they're going to take some credit losses. So the other thing that Canadian banks tend to do is they make reasonably plain vanilla corporate loans to largely investment grade the companies in Canada, the US. So we're not going to get involved and share risk on their resi portfolios, but we'll absolutely share risk with those Canadian banks on their corporate portfolios so they can shore up the capital to take the hits that they may have to take on their residential book. UK banks, same kind of thing. And, you know, Switzerland, you have a consolidation going on. And in the US, with the changeover to the Biden administration, the OCC and the Fed just sort of didn't sign off on this for a couple of years. So there's a bit of a backlog. And now, you know, there are many believe, I'm one of them, apparently Jamie Dimon is another, who believe that, you know, we're not totally out of the woods in this regional and super-regional banking crisis that the First Republics and the Silicon Valley banks have exposed. And so what you see is, you know, the big banks taking advantage of this as a more efficient way, and I would say cheaper way for them to raise capital. Because if and when said banking crisis happens, if they're overcapitalized going into that, they'll either be forced to take these smaller banks, or they may opportunistically want to do so. So right now you have a whole bunch of different reasons in different regions, but right now is a kind of third golden age, if you will, of this SRT or regulatory capital relief market.
So let me ask you a tangential question. You talked about Switzerland, and just last week we had an episode with Colm Kelleher, chair of UBS, former Morgan Stanley, where, you know, and a fixed income man. And his point is that regulation is fine in the banking sector, but if you keep on squeezing and squeezing and regulating and you push more assets out into the unregulated, you could have unintended consequences. So whilst you said it's good for you and other players, from a societal and from a, you know, a higher level of actual risk, isn't there a danger is that we've got more and more assets moving into the unregulated space?
Well, look, if I were Jamie Dimon or our column or I were the head of or I were any of the others, that's exactly the point I would be making, because I would want, you know, to keep control and I wouldn't want too much regulation. The answer is there's always a balance, and the pendulum will swing and could swing where the so-called non-banking or shadow banking sector, there could be risk in that, that potentially, especially if it's sold to retail investors, that could cause what we focused on a lot at the Fed, systemic problems. Having said that, that could happen. And where I think the regulator should pay a lot of attention is if any of this shadow banking, whether it's what we do or the more common non-bank lending, middle market lending that's going, if that starts going to retail and less sophisticated investors, I think the regulators need to pay very close attention to that to make sure that the people know what they're actually buying. Most of our clients are sophisticated investors, and you know they have consultants who are sophisticated, so we very much require that they know what they're investing in. Having now said that disclaimer, some of this, and I actually at the IMF had at their April sort of World Bank IMF meetings, they had a kind of symposium on this, and the SEC and others were there. It's important to frame the question a little bit. By most people's estimates, this non-banking or shadow banking lending and other solutions, you know, maybe it's a $2 trillion, maybe 1.5, maybe 2.5, but that order of magnitude. I mentioned that the top 100 banks control $100 trillion in assets. But if you look at banking in general, if you include the other 10,000 or so, there's something like 200 to 250 trillion credit risk loans in the banking sector. So while we need to make sure that, you know, retail investors are not being misled, even the explosive growth of our sector, of not just our solution, but all of this, again, shadow banking, if you want to call it that, yes, it has been explosive. It's gone from 500 billion to 2 trillion, 4x in, you know, an 8 or 10 year period. So that's a steep growth, but let's keep it in context. That's 2 trillion in a $200 trillion swimming pool. So we, of course, whenever there's something new and different, it needs to be looked at to make sure that systemic risk isn't entered into the economy and small and unsophisticated investors are protected. But let's not get our knickers in a twist too much about that. Let's not overstate the issue.
Got it. And so we fast forwarded 5 years, how might that distribution between the bank and the non-financial sector look? Much more consolidation within the banks and more transfer of these assets outside?
Yeah, well, you know, that's a good question. And it's more likely than not that this privatization of bank assets will continue. But here I'm going to differentiate Orchard and the types of stuff we do from many of our, you know, much larger competitors. If you think about it, what, you know, the big money managers and private equity shops that are moving into fixed income, what they're saying is because of Basel II, III, IV, because of more stringent regulation, banks can't lend like they used to. So their value proposition is give money to us. We are going to disintermediate the banks, kind of cut them out of the, that's not what we are looking to do. I like to call us the opposite of that. I like to call us the anti-disintermediators. Because what we do is we recognize that banks are really good originators. And they're really good servicers. And they really understand their clients in ways that no private company can, because in addition to lending to them, they're also doing cash management. They get non-public information. They see things. They know that borrower better than anybody, number one. Number two, if and when, and it happens, you know, one of their borrowers defaults, they have workout groups and they have people who all they do is find a solution so that to the borrower. So we think that banks have a lot of value in the value chain. They're just not the best place to store all of the capital. So what we like to say is we work with banks. Now, it's not securitization a la Countrywide Credit, where they don't care what they're originating. They're just trying to get that hot potato off the books. No. When we do our transactions, we expect them to keep our bank partners meaningful and significant parts of the risk. So we're sharing. So if we lose money, they often lose more. And so long as you do it that way, we like to say, we are the people who are keeping the banking system vibrant. We allow the banks to do what they do best, but share the capital in a more capital efficient way. So I think we are actually helping the banking system grow, whereas many of our competitors actually are trying to cut the banks out. And maybe I'll be there with Jamie Dimon and the others saying, you know, you shouldn't do that. You should do more of this. So that's what I mean. That's why it's so critical, that advice I got from that senior Morgan Stanley executive, because it absolutely defined what I learned in that, you know, it was less than 2 years at the Fed. It has defined every part of my career, including, you know, when I founded or co-founded Orchard and what we're doing now.
Who or which type of client is particularly suitable for what you do?
Well, the two biggest pools of capital for us are sovereign wealth and state and corporate pension plans. Sovereign wealth, we all know who they are. They're in the Gulf, they're in Southeast Asia. They actually have a couple sovereign wealth funds in North America as well. The other big pool of capital for us is the, you know, state pension plans, and that's public. And all I will say, and you know, the New Yorks, and we have some New York money, and the, actually, we don't have as much California money, but a lot of Mountain West. What I will say, without getting into sort of our client list in too much detail, you can figure it out from the internet, is there are a lot of people, ourselves included, who are focusing a lot on the Gulf as a pool of capital, and that's great. We have some of the early and big investors of ours came from the Gulf. We would be nowhere if it weren't for, I'll just say it, if it weren't for Singapore and Abu Dhabi, we would be nowhere. More recently, Qatar and others. But everybody's going, setting up offices, you know, in the UAE. Here's one for you. Texas and New Mexico pump more oil and gas, but for sure oil, than Abu Dhabi and Qatar combined. So it should come as no surprise that I like to say wherever there's oil, there's money these days. You know, with oil being probably twice what it otherwise would be if there weren't a war going on and there weren't these restrictions in the U.S. So obviously, there's Canada. There's a lot of capital in Canada. We have Canadian roots. There's a lot of capital in the sort of, you know, Texas, New Mexico, and some of the other, you know, Colorado. There's a lot of capital in the Gulf, in certain countries in Southeast Asia. And people don't think of it this way, but, you know, Australia's done pretty well with that commodities boom as well. So there's other places, you know, North Asia. We have a small office in Seoul. Those are the big sources of capital. And sovereign wealth and pension, both state and corporate, in this country, we have some, but not much, ultra high net worth. We're not really on the leading edge of that. We're looking at it now. So I think for the industry, that will happen. We'll try to be a smart second mover rather than a frontiering first mover on that trend.
And when you talked earlier on about investors coming to you by and large to stay rich, this is sort of, you know, because they're not taking equity style risk. You have a CLO business, collateral loan obligations. You know, they went through a tricky time in the GFC. Do I see a slight mismatch in what you said about preserving capital and loans issued down the capital stack?
Sure. So I'm glad you asked that question. Allow me to sort of clarify my statements. If you look at what we do, we're in between 8 and 9, but let's just say we're at 10 billion because that's where I want the company to go and those numbers are easier. Actually, about 5 to 10% or 500 million to a billion is higher beta stuff, that CLO business. Now, it's more volatile for sure. So 5 or 10% of the business is beta or even leverage beta. We actually have about 5 to 10% of our business in, for lack of a better word, I call negative beta, which does well when the market isn't doing well, because that's the way it's positioned.
Is that because it's short CDS or it's long insurance, or how does that,
yeah,
is that?
It's a long short fund that uses credit derivative indices and options to, so if we had, if I achieved my goal of growing to 10 billion, about 500 million to a billion is in the beta plus, and about 500 million to a billion is in the negative beta. But the core of what we do, 80% is what I like to call smart beta. You're long rather than long short, but we like to say defensive long. As an example, we've done now, since we started the company, almost 80 transactions, these regulatory capital, you know, over the last decade or so. You know, it's pretty large notional. We've taken about 160 billion in credit risk. But we've been tested with all kinds of different things, you know, markets in the last year. So that shows the resilience, at least that we've had historically, and hopefully we'll continue to have going forward.
And for potential investors listening, what's the typical structure of your funds? Available to all institutional investors globally or segmented by country and by currency?
Yeah, you know, we have most of our funds are for quite large investors. Our minimums tend to be high. We have one product that's our longest running product. It's going to come up on its 20th birthday soon. It's a nice fund, and that can take, that's a standard open-ended hedge fund structure, but that can take investment sizes down to 250,000. So that's where we get a lot of our more mass affluent. We do have a lot of private credit, like a private debt funds, where you make a commitment, there's a drawdown for 2 or 3 years, we invest, there's a reinvestment period, and we give it back. So we do have those. Having said that, the trend in the business, and for sure with us as well, is something like a hybrid.
Paul, it's been terrific talking to you about Orchard Global. I think you've very clearly laid out what you do, why you do it, and who are the right sort of investors to be going with you. And no shortage of opportunity as the banks deal with their own challenges. And is there anything that I haven't asked you?
Well, you haven't asked me if Chelsea is going to be first or second or third this year in the Premiership. And my prediction there is, let's see, Chelsea is going to make it into the Champions League. And that's very important to us here at Orchard Global as well.
Why is that?
I was one of the few Chelsea fans who actually lived nearby. And on Saturdays, I was like, what's this noise? And I kind of went in the late 90s and said, what is this? And I had played, we call it soccer in the U.S., and they said, well, Chelsea. And I said, can I buy a ticket? And yeah, and I went in there and it was Chelsea-Arsenal game. It's amazing that I could get a ticket. But anyway, so I became, when I was working in the banks, I started with 4 tickets and I just kept adding and adding and adding, you know, when the renewals came through. And I ended up being one of the largest private members of Chelsea Football Club as it went through Abramovich buying and selling and all that other kind of stuff. And I'm not going to argue with the policymakers, but those sanctions, they had to do what they had to do. But it's kind of unfair, I think, I understand the owner was Russian, but Chelsea's still digging its way out of those. So we're not going to win it this year, but we're going to be in the top 4.
I'm smiling because in the room we have an intern, Archie Graves, an Arsenal supporter, and we are releasing, it will have been released by the time this podcast is out, but we had Ian Charles of Arctos, 8 billion of sports assets, stakes in all sorts. I asked him about the Chelsea. I think it's his friend who is one of the investors, and he neatly evaded the question on the investment merits of that particular transaction.
But so, I won't get into that. I think all of these, I think the prices being paid for all these clubs is, it doesn't seem to make, by the way, it's not just the UK, the US. I mean, the other guy, the podcast guy, knows what he's talking about. So I don't know about return for, you know, Clearlake or whoever, but I do think Arsenal will be right up there in the top 4 with us. But I'm going out on a limb, and I think there's a little wishful thinking. I mean, I'm more confident in my election sort of predictions, but I aspirationally hope that we can be in the top 4.
Well, I'll just conclude by saying I think your investors will be very happy that you don't profess any great expertise in football forecasting. So you probably do need to stick to what you know.
What I will say, and I don't want to sort of throw darts at anybody else, whenever your manager starts showing up at art auctions and they start buying football teams, that's when you're supposed to get concerned. We're very focused on what other people think is boring, but you know, the world of regulatory capital relief and credit derivatives, we're a bunch of nerds. Most of our analysts come from, you know, French technical schools and places like the Wharton Business School. I went to Harvard Business School. So we're good old fashioned structured credit, ex-Federal Reserve finance geeks. And, you know, stay away from some of that. We'll watch a football game, but you're not going to see us buying anything anytime soon.
Paul, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making or refraining from making any specific investment or other decisions. We try to provide content that is true and accurate as of the date of publishing. However, we give no assurance or warranty regarding the accuracy, timeliness, or applicability of any of the content. Guests, presenters, and other individuals involved in the production of this podcast may have positions in any of the investments discussed.